It's Wednesday, June 11th, 2008, and you're listening to episode 103 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 51 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is John.
And my name is Chris.
All right, let's go ahead and get an announcement and some heavy stuff out of the way first before we get down to the RPG goodness. The announcement is we have a post on our forum from a guy by the name of Bad Mr. Mojo. He is with a group that is trying to do a D&D marathon, and they're taking pledges and such to raise money for something called the Adsom House, which is a shelter for women that are either homeless or being battered or whatnot. And this is a chance for you not only to donate to a really good cause, but also raise the positive profile of gamers as a whole. So if you are at all interested in donating to their effort, which they are calling No Country for Old Gnomes, then I will have a link to this. In the show notes. And I'm going to make a donation. I definitely hope you guys will get out there and make a donation. And don't wait on this, because the cutoff for donations is going to come pretty quickly after this episode drops. So if you're interested in supporting your fellow gamers or supporting these women, then please get out there and hit that up.
If you can't be an athlete, then be an athletic supporter.
If you can't play football, play D&D.
There you go.
Actually, play D&D anyway.
I'd rather play.
I have known several athletes who play D&D, and it's a terrible stereotype, you know, that they can't.
Chris, you could have at least used a slightly more attractive analogy. If you can't play sports, at least be a sports bra.
Oh, there you go.
See, that's a whole lot better than being an athletic supporter.
Absolutely, and generally a lot less sweaty.
All right, the heavy stuff. This is something that I have not brought up on the show to this point, and I really don't know why, because there's a lot of stuff here that this show being comprised of a whole bunch of different people. Sometimes we don't talk about everything that's going on because it digs into our personal lives, and, you know, to explain it would break that fourth wall a little bit too much. But this is something that really doesn't fit into that category, and yet I haven't talked about it on the show, and I kind of regret having not done so. And
you have the chlamydia.
I do have chlamydia. And that issue
I'm clapping over here.
Aw.
Don't be crabby. And that issue is why we've been a
syphilis.
Little irregular in our show releases. And
not enough fiber.
What we've gotten hit with is a whole bunch of, well, one expected and a whole bunch of unexpected issues with the hosting. The one expected issue is that Matt was out of the country for about 2 weeks, and now his job is going to have him living in Tennessee for several months. We were having some sound problems with Chris. We're still having sound problems with Tex. Luke is basically, he's feeling a lot of burnouts and has decided to go on vacation, as has Chad. So this show has been reduced to a very, very slim pickings of people. And being a show that has always thrived on discussion and that roundtable format, that's made it kind of hard for us to carry on the show. And so this is why we've been missing a couple weeks, because we'll get together and find we don't have what I consider the minimum of three people to even record the show.
The fellowship is sundered.
So here's what we are going to do. Fear the Boot is still going to go on in some form or another, but I just accept the fact that it's the nature of life that all things must change and adapt in order to move forward. So we have some ideas for trying to bolster the hosting and keep the show going, at least on a semi-regular basis. We may be drawing on some people like Keith Curtis, bringing them back for some one-shot shows. Don Dem from Pulp Gamers also volunteered to help us out. And in addition to that, we are also looking at launching a couple additional show types that we can do with the resources we have access to. But we might do some fiction readings or talking about game development or things like that. And I realize that this is a change to the show, and while our original format's not going to ever completely go away, it is going to be replaced on some weeks by different show formats. Some people are like that, some people are going to hate that, and that's just the way it goes. And I guess all I can say to you guys is please understand that this is not a matter of us saying, well, you know, we've perfected this and done all we can, so now we need to move on to bigger and better things. It's more a matter of us trying to keep this show alive with the resources that we have. So please understand that this is us doing what we can. This is not what we consider to be an ideal choice. Now, having said that, some of the ideas we've kicked around, which I will talk about in more detail in episode 104, I'm actually really excited about, think we can get some really kick-ass shows out of them, and hopefully they will still be on topics that interest gamers and geeks in general. It's just, like I said, understand that things are going to have to change a little bit. So, enough of the heavy stuff. John, this past weekend or week,
I ran Keep on the Shadowfell, at least half of it.
Do you want to explain what that is for anyone who's not familiar?
Score 1 point for Mike Merles, the anonymous master of Dungeons & Dragons. There's basically a keep on a portal where there's bad demons coming out, and there's a hand that comes out of it and takes the bad guy. So that's the whole spoiler. But anyway, I went up to Chicago to meet with some friends from Loyola that I made through the Rome program that took me from the podcast for so many months ago. And we got around and did the little Keep on the Shadowfell thing. We didn't have any of the new source books, and we just used slightly altered pre-made characters. None of them had played D&D before, but had wanted to for a while.
Were rules included in the mod itself?
Yes, there is a
or basic rules,
brief but adequate system for how to run combats and how to make.
And this is the first sort of testing the water module for 4th edition D&D. Correct?
Exactly, it is the first thing they put out. They put it out well before they put out the source books. It's just how the game runs, levels 1 through 3 with no frills. I mean, there's no item creation. There are no crazy destiny quests or whatever the hell they've got planned. There's just the bad guys, the good guys, and what each can do. And some pretty good little battle maps. We used minis, so that was fun. Secret discovery of the week. The Lord of the Rings Risk game is chock full of little plastic goblins and elves that fit perfectly into a 1-inch square.
Ooh.
Save yourself hundreds of dollars on D&D minis and buy it.
Well, I've always been a big believer, don't buy brand name minis from anywhere. If you need your generic fantasy or sci-fi figs, always shop around with places like Reaper that sell, you know, you go through the D&D ones and you can buy a D&D elf for $5 or $10. You can go through Reaper and buy it for like $1.25 or whatnot. So,
I don't even, what is that, Reaper.com?
It's Reaper Mini or ReaperMinis.com. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But
and of course, then if you buy Reaper miniatures, you can always then do Reaper Miniature Theater and have your miniatures do little acts. That was always fun.
I don't know about that, Chris. That sounds kind of dorky.
That was what we do. But, you know, related to that, though, and I don't want to get you too off track, the old Milton Bradley game, Fortress America, was perfect for that.
I have wanted to play that game for so long.
Is I have
it in
that
print
game.
Still? You have it?
Basically, when you play it, if you're not thinking and feeling and living Red Dawn,
dude,
you're
that's
not,
what I was saying. I was saying it's basically my Red Dawn simulator.
Oh, absolutely! And the best thing about it, or the best side thing about it, is that the helicopters and the hover tanks in that game, and even the mobile units, made for excellent BattleTech miniatures.
Right,
they work perfect not only because they matched up with things in the game, but you could fit two of them in a hex no problem, which of course was the space limitations for one hex in BattleTech for tanks.
Before we tangent too much into Chris's gaming closet, which is something we want to get to here in a second, John,
John wants Red Dawn to happen in real life.
Yeah. What is your, I think I've told this before, but I took a personality inventory once, and one of the questions on there was true or false. Every so often, I think a nuclear war wouldn't be such a bad thing. I'll let you all guess how I answered. But so, John, what was your first brush with 4th edition like?
My first brush with 4th edition was very, very positive. I went in with a keen, low-looking eyeball for what it screwed up and what I've been deprived from 2nd and 3rd edition, like I'm sure all the rest of us old curmudgeons did. But I found very little. At the very outset of the game, at the least, I'm going to say unequivocally that it's good. Everyone has something to do, and they're always doing it. The level 1 wizard and the level 1 cleric don't suck anymore. That's my big point I'm taking away from
it. I'd have to agree with you on that.
I thought they fixed that, though, even in 3rd edition, in my mind.
The level 1 wizard still has
He's still a one-shot wonder and carries a crossbow very well afterwards as in a 3rd edition wizard. But John, I'd have to agree with you.
You had the bonus intelligence spell, so he wasn't the one-shot wonder.
Okay, he
anymore.
Was the two-shot wonder.
Well,
whoop
three or four-shot wonder, but yeah, all right.
No, dude, in 4th edition, the magic missile is flying every round. Occasionally, the acid arrow goes, and the burning hands as well. But you were saying, Chris?
I agree with you. The magic missile is the point I would have gotten to, because basically my opinion was that it pretty much turned first edition or first level wizards into little miniature Avengers. You know, he always shot just bolts out of his hand basically every round, no matter what spell it was a bolt out of his hand.
Unless there's a 10 kobold minions, in which case that little area of effect fireball thing that can kill, you know, 5 of them at once is suddenly very popular.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I was in Worldwide D&D Day on the 6th. And that was my experience, first experience
D&D
for 4th edition.
Day on June 6th. Day. That's so cute.
No, because D-Day was actually the 5th, was the day before.
No, it got canceled on the 5th. It was supposed to be on the 5th, but weather forced it back to the 6th.
Correct.
Oh, well, there you go. All right, well, see, that's what I get for trusting Wikipedia. So
I'm pretty sure Wikipedia has it right.
Well, because I put little history tidbits on my voicemail every day on my answering machine, and for June 5th, I was pretty sure that's what I put was the start of the D-Day invasion. But that's beside the point.
Not everyone who left you a message that day knows you're a moron.
They should call my work phone. I have little history tidbits every day. It's wonderful.
All right, so now, John, one of the big...
Hey, I think Chris was still making a point.
The other point I was making is I enjoyed 4th edition, too. I left the table thinking, you know, was this really Dungeons & Dragons? Hell, I have no idea. But, you know,
it
the
was
rules
Dungeons
mechanics...
And Dragons.
The rules mechanic works. It was a good game. Everyone did have something to do. My rogue that I had, he was fine. He was able to do things. He had gorgeous hair.
That's good.
You know, and I got to keep it after it was done. So, you know, it was fun.
Yeah, the rogues, the sneak attack is good this time around. It's not just the stealth jump. Anytime, basically, they're flanked or you have combat advantage, the rogue can be doing that 2d8, which makes them a really serious piece of glass cannon artillery.
So, now, John, one of the big concerns / complaints about 4th edition was that it looked and played too much like a video game.
It plays a lot like a video game, but not in a bad way. I think a lot of the things that we ourselves have complained about that RPGs have kept on into the 21st century that are just dumb, you know, the 4-hit-pointed wizard, the daily spells, all this sorts of crap, they've done away with. Your weakling characters can actually take a few hits now. I had a halfling throwing rocks at the wizard and it didn't just kill her in one round. It was amazing.
I was kind of reminded of Gauntlet Legends in a certain way, with the exception of running around and grabbing food. You can basically just kind of stand there and go, and then you can get some hit points back.
Yep. Yeah. The healing surge thing, jury's still out on that. I think that's diminished the cleric quite a bit, although the new cleric is good.
Mm-hmm.
There are arcadey elements. The minion monsters, especially, these are just 1-hit-pointed paper dragons running around, sitting there begging you to kill them en masse because that's just cool. That's very Diablo 2, but I can deal with it. There's tactics the GM can use with them. I mean, each one of them gives the other one another point in its attack roll, so if you get a little wave of them going, they can start adding up. But my point was, it plays a little bit more MMO-y these days. It was not World of Warcraft, the pen and paper game.
Okay.
It's never going to be World of Warcraft, the pen and paper
game. So it sounds like you were entertained by it, but let's now get to what really matters, the dollar vote. Are you going to go out and buy it? Are you going to stick with 3035, 20?
Well, I haven't decided yet. I have not bought the core rule books. I might eventually. I'm not even done running Keep on the Shadowfell. My people only made it to second level. It's a long adventure, especially if you're playing through some newbies that have to be handheld. We'll see.
Eventually, maybe, but on any immediate basis, no, I won't. But I have to say, though, for when I was at my FLGS... and other tables were running this. People were going up and they were, you know, buying the whole slipcase with the 3 books in there, and they were sitting it with them and getting ready to pay for it and everything once they had started running through it.
Oh, yeah, I have no doubt this is going to do well. By the standards of the role-playing game sales these days, certainly, and perhaps even by the wider standards of any creative endeavor.
Do you feel a change was necessary? Did you get anything out of 4th edition where you really felt like, okay, if I've got to reinvest $100, $200 in various books and side material, did you really think that this was this is a worthwhile change, or is this just...
Gygax said, of course, that the secret that we were never going to tell them is that they don't need any of the books at all. And that's kind of always true. Ultimately, it's a game where you roll a 20-sided dice and you try to get a high number, and you play pretend around that. That said, at the earliest phases of the opening game, at the low levels... it is way better than 3E. If that can be used as a justification to purchase it, yes.
I know that if I did get it and actually actively started playing it, I know because it's, and from my honest unfamiliarity with it, I know that they've kind of broken up the level groupings into these various categories. I don't ever see myself playing anything that would be of any high-level aspects. I mean, to me, you know, the first-level characters that were there, they had enough potency to them that really I'd be satisfied with. You know, most games I run, I prefer to have my characters, my PCs have some sort of vulnerability. I like to be able to present them with some sort of challenge that would still seem plausible in the mundane fantasy world that you're in. Rather than have them trumpsing around, you know, and
fighting
being
gods
super
and elder gold worms
exactly.
all the time.
You know, yeah. that's not me. I wouldn't, you know, no hacking campaigns really would appeal to me at all. And so, clearly that could happen.
The other question is, do you play high power, high level games? And I mean, as back as far as second edition and third edition, certainly, I never played D&D with characters that were above, eighth or ninth level. In third edition was the worst offender. The dice rolls you had to make every single round, all the additions you had to add for the high level characters were just insane. But second edition was pretty bad too. I don't play the superpower games. Yeah. I don't find them engaging.
Personally, I always felt like the sweet spot of D&D was somewhere between third and like eighth or ninth level.
Yeah. Because I'll start my people
seven.
Between one and three. And usually the natural effect of game death will take care of this, but they never leveled up past 8 or 9.
Yeah, because I just always felt that if you start them off at first level, I mean, even the fighter can't take that many hits.
Yeah.
And I always felt like once you got beyond that, that you had so departed from any kind of a rational human fear. I mean, you could walk into a castle at level 15.
Yeah.
And
the economic scale of it gets equally ridiculous.
Yeah,
you're carrying a small nation's GDP on your back. Eventually, you're carrying more money than the whole rest of the world combined has.
Right. And then the level 1 guards or level 0 guards, there's been a which edition you're talking about, that maybe have their level 2 or 3 captain somewhere.
Yeah,
and
maybe actually a fighter class, probably more a warrior class.
Yeah, and they might have that level 5 court wizard somewhere, and you can just hack your way from one end to the other. I don't know. It just always seemed to me to depart so far from any kind of sensibility. You know, some people like that. Some people really want to play those wildly heroic games, but
I did that at the very beginning of my D&D career. I bought the red box for second edition with the crappy CD and the dice and stuff.
Okay.
And there were stats on when you went back to town, what the guard captain had and what the wizard mentor you were working for had. And the game was like, the PC shouldn't fight these guys. They'll kick their butts. And I said, oh, really?
For me, it was if the PCs couldn't pass, you know, the quote unquote tavern test, then it was pointless to try and really play that. You know, if I couldn't picture these PCs still being able to walk into that stereotypical tavern and sitting down and getting that ale and just relaxing or socializing with the NPCs that were there in that town, it's not a game I really wanted to engage in. Because that's kind of like that's my litmus test for reality in that fantasy world. You still want your PCs to be able to, you know, I guess, interact with the great unwashed.
Yeah, I had the color animal in my last game here. That's what it was called. I thought it was clever.
All right, Chris's gaming closet. Chris, this is something you tossed out. It sounds so dirty. This is something that you tossed out to me earlier. You were going through your gaming collection, finding all these obscure games that you've never played, or at least the way you implied it to me is you never played them.
Basically.
And I think that most people that are particularly GMs, those that collect games, end up having in their collection a stack of games that might be obscure, might not be, but at any rate, these are the games you picked up, brought home,
never played,
read through, loved, and yet never, ever played. Maybe because you never got around to it, maybe because you had no gaming group, more than likely because your gaming group was so damn obstinate that if it wasn't their favorite 1, 2, or 3 systems, then they weren't going to touch it. And I have a bunch of these. Chris, since you brought this up, I'll let you go first. I'm curious what some of yours are.
Yeah, and you know, and that's true. And really what I found to be, at least from my group as we began our gaming careers, was it usually took about a year to get people interested in playing a game. You know, you'd go and purchase the game. I mean, Shadowrun, when it first came out, was a perfect example of this. I bought it when it first came out. And it took a year to finally convince everybody in the group to actually give it a shot. And once we gave it a shot, that game quickly became the standard. And then you would do that for a couple of years, and then the next game would come around, and you'd still have to wait a year. Deadlands was another good example of that. It took a year to actually get going in that game.
Were you running, or were you just playing in these groups?
Both, whether it was running or playing.
Dude, if you're running, just smack them with the old velvet glove and say, I'm running this new system. Override me and run something else if you want to.
Well, you know, you could do that, but see, but then the problem is if you force them to run it and then they'll get kind of, you know, Doug and Wendy Weiner about it all, then it's like, why am I, you know, why do we even bother? And you don't want that. Oh, yeah. You don't want that headache. So
if they're really whiny windbags, then that doesn't work, I guess.
Well, I've had this problem too, because even if they won't actively fight me, they'll passively fight me. They won't take it seriously. They'll jack around with it. They'll overblow any problems they find in the system.
Well, you've played with players who do that with every system, even the ones they like.
Yeah, fair enough. But I've seen them redouble their efforts when, you know, if I sit them down to, and this depends on the group we're talking about, but with some of my past groups, if I sit them down to a game I know they like, they really will work hard to make a good game out of it. But when I set them down to a game they don't like, they will work equally hard to sabotage it, oftentimes without even giving it a chance, which
absolutely,
which perturbs me. But hey, that's just the way life
is. When they do that, I take it as an opportunity to cede the GM chair. It's the old rule about picking a restaurant. If you're going to shoot down my idea,
yeah, come but up with see, a better one. Now, once again, this depends on the group. But in some of my groups, I've been kind of afraid to do that because there are people I know who would happily and eagerly GM.
But suck.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Just to be brutally honest, their games are really freaking boring, and so I don't dare play that.
See, I've been pretty lucky. I've been in groups where no one wants a GM, and that's fine. That's almost constant. But I've never really known a guy who thought he was great at GMing and enjoyed it and just couldn't do it.
Oh, I've known several. All right, but let's get down to the game list. First one for me, the original Legend of the Five Rings, not the D20 version, but the original one that was played with D10s. I picked this one up because I happened to be, years ago, I was driving around talking to Chad, and I happened to mention to him that I said, you know, I really like the European fantasy of D&D. I would love to see a game that is accurately Asiatic fantasy. It's not David Carradine, Kung Fu movie type stuff. But this is something that really captures their legends and their mythologies and whatever and plays it out well in a game. He recommended Legend of the Five Rings, picked it up. It's still a book to this day that I think is one of the best constructed RPGs I've seen. Can't comment on the rules mechanics, we never played it, but just in terms of the amount of work they put into the feel, the setting, teaching you the courtesies and just a few phrases in Japanese. Great put together book.
The Joe Whitey effect.
But we never played it, never once played it, simply because we never got around to it. And I think part of the thing that kept us from getting around to it was it seemed like there was very few play options, that the way the game was structured, unless you really knew the setting and time period inside and out, you were kind of restricted to playing the katana and wakizashi wielding samurai. And that
surely there was a ninja.
Not that I recall. I remember there being samurai. There was some kind of a wizard class. And I don't recall there being like a ninja. And of course, you know, samurai, you can have samurai that aren't fighters. You can have historically samurai who are poets or courtesans or all kinds of other things. But the game just didn't seem to support enough play options out of the box, or at least that's how it struck us. And so eventually other shiny things distracted us, and we have never once played that game. Chris, give me one of yours.
I'll grab off the top of the pile here. And I, you know, most of mine I'm finding as I was unpacking from the move, and I kind of left some of the more, I guess you could say, well-known obscure games, if that makes any sense. But this is an older one. This is a book I hardly even ever looked at, but I got it. It's called Yzgarth, Advanced Role-Playing. It's by Ragnarok.
I think I've heard of that, but what is it?
It's someone else's version of D&D back, you know, in the second edition days. And you could tell it's very indie in the sense that the layout is pretty pretty basic. The artwork, moderately good.
Because it sucks.
Are you trying to say crappy without saying crappy?
I'm trying to, yeah, you know, if you don't have anything good to say, don't say anything at all. So I'm trying to be as nice as possible. But
this is Reboot, dude.
Yeah, we'd have about 120 episodes of dead air if that was the case. So
it looks like dog crap in between the covers. And even the artwork on the cover artwork is only mildly interesting. And I'm not even sure how I actually came into possession of this game, but I do say it, the name itself is probably one of the worst names you could choose for a name of a game. I mean, it's spelled Y-S-G-A-R-T-H.
So get two people to pick that up and pronounce it the same way and
exactly. Give them a medal. You suddenly get into a Drow-Dro controversy at that point.
It's Dro.
Or Drow.
No,
actually, I'm with you. It is Dro.
I'm Drow, so I guess there really is somebody on the other side of this debate. But we also get into the harassment and guillotine and all that kind of stuff. But we'll save that for another podcast. But, you know, Chris, I tell you, though, with the indie games, some of the best games I've ever played have had very crappy layouts. And not to say, you know, I love a game with a good layout, but I will put up with a layout provided the content is on par.
Sure.
One of the games we talked about, and this one we did play, but it's a rather obscure game we've mentioned before, was an independent game called Justifiers. And the layout and the structure of just how the game was set up internally was perfect. But they had a great idea. They gave you a lot of good stuff to work with. And we played it for quite a while and had a ton of fun doing so. And I would happily play it again if I owned a copy of it. Unfortunately, the guy that had a copy of it has died, literally, at the ripe old age of like 32, 33. So, you know, Godspeed to him. But, I'll have to try and track down a copy of this like on eBay or something.
I bought the Dragon Ball Z RPG in like 1998. I never want to find it again, and I certainly never want to play it.
Another game I picked up, this one is not obscure at all, but it's a game that I've picked up and it has done nothing but gather dust, is I have the three primary rule books for the Robotech game. I have
the
first, second, and third, the Zentradi, Robotech Masters, and Inv Invasion, and those are games that I so desperately wanted to play. I'll take it back. I also have the Sentinel War one. But those were games that I so desperately wanted to play because I love the books. I love the setting. There's a lot of neat stuff in there. But quite frankly, the Palladium rule system is such an awkward mess that I could never get anyone to buy into playing it. And honestly, I can't blame them. But those are still games that if I ever found a system to readapt them into that I thought really worked, and made the transition easy where I didn't have to effectively rewrite 200 pages of material to make it work, I would love to play them still. I had this great idea for this campaign about the REF where I was going to have, they were going to be in command of these two destroyers that were off kind of wandering space and exploring. And I had all kinds of things they were going to run into and little side battles they were going to get involved in, and just couldn't get any traction with the players because of the rule system. And as a result, never went anywhere. Did a few lone wolf games. Chad will never admit this probably, but I did a few lone wolf games of Inv Invasion with Chad.
You lone wolf with Chad?
We did.
That's dirty.
We had a, you know what?
But I explained lone wolfing to my newbies last weekend. They giggled.
Yeah, I think lone wolf games can work. It takes a particular type of GM, particular type of player, particular type of system.
An involved couple.
Oh, here we go. But I've had some really good games. Actually, one of the best lone wolf games I ever played, believe this one or not, and I may have to bleep this out, but it was a Spelljammer game.
Oh, disgusting. Ooh. Were you the hamster or was she?
Actually, I was playing a lizard man because it's one of the few settings
that even grosser
supports lizard
cloaca
man
or a sleaze stack. I played Robotech. Played Robotech once, and I agree with you. I spent most of the session, I think, scratching my head, but I love the idea of being a Veritech pilot, so that was cool.
I was always a fan of the Cyclones. I love the motorcycle powered armor. In fact, I was really excited a couple of years ago when they came out with that game. I don't know what all platforms it was on. I got it for the PlayStation 2 where you could play a Cyclone pilot. Great game. It's not one you're going to want to really replay. It's a rental, but definitely worth picking up for the one playthrough. I had a ton of fun flipping back and forth from motorcycle form to powered armor form.
Yeah, I think we had about a jillion copies of that game at GameStop when I worked there a few years ago, and no one bought them.
It was a ton. I highly recommend the game for a single playthrough. It's got some neat plot elements to it if you really pay attention to what's going on. The motorcycle, you know, kind of driving around and jumping over stuff was a lot of fun. I beat it and have not touched it since. It's definitely one that should have been a rental. Chris, anything else in your gaming closet that?
I got a pile here. We could.
All right, give us a couple more here.
We'll shoot through here. I have, again by Ragnarok. I have By the Gods, which is a mythological role playing game where you can play the role of demigods and heroes and fight the forces of monstrous evil in the setting of classical myth. We got that one. This next one, I was particularly fond of because, again, I'm a fan of the whole post apocalyptic genre. And so this kind of in the whole Skies of Glass theme, I have Blood Dawn by ODS, Optimus Design Systems. And this actually was put out. It looks pretty good, actually, for an RPG. The artwork in here is good. It fits the mood of the game. Again, this is one I bought, really wanted to play, never would have been able to play. And it's post-apocalyptic in the sense that there's mutants, there's magic, there's, of course, large weapons, all kinds of fun things. There's a little picture of kids playing soccer in here with a human skull. There's all kinds of wonderful, wonderful things in here. And the cover of it, of course, has the standard Statue of Liberty lying on the ground.
Right. Of course,
on the cover.
Escape from New York.
And the mushroom cloud in the background. And
Yep. It's the guy with the stop sign as a shield, that kind of thing. Blood Dawn is the name of the company. I think I bought this one here at a Gen Con. I have an honorable mention here, and just only because it's near the top of the pile. This is not a game, but it is a generic fantasy setting, and it's the name of the accessory. It's called the Town of Baldemar, and it's an entire town described out. It has a map. It's designed for your generic RPG fantasy setting. And the only reason I picked this one out is because it was made by the company New Infinities Productions, which was the first company. The first products of that Gary Gygax was involved with after he left TSR.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they put out The Town of Baldemar, and then I think the first RPG they put out was Cyborg Commando, which was you're a cyborg in the far future, kind of a dark future kind of thing. I never bought it because that looked extremely bad.
Stupid.
Oh, gosh.
I don't think I would drop Cyber Commandos in a town called Baldemar.
No.
Well, and I hesitate about any game where you don't have a setting in a system, you have a profession that you are playing X in setting Y, and that's it.
Yes.
So I always kind of hesitate about those games. Now, I don't know if Cyborg Commando is that, but from the title being Cyborg Commando, I'm guessing you play Cyborg Commandos. And
that's basically what you did. I think, if I remember correctly, there were aliens involved, and so the Cyborg Commandos, of course, were some sort of special elite force designed to help fight these alien overlords, that kind of thing, if I'm remembering it correctly.
Chris, if you got technology to make cyborgs, you might as well go ahead and make robots and have nobody undergoing grotesque surgeries at all. I tell you, one of the things about cyborgs that's always fascinated me, right now, playing Age of Conan, I've become acutely aware of just how quickly computers become outdated because the gaming rig I bought for playing, I don't know, EQ2 or something like that, maybe 2 years ago, now really won't run Age of Conan all that well. Can you imagine having that be something that's surgically in you?
Yeah, I can, because I played Deus Ex, and the tension between the mechs and the nanolog agents is palpable.
But, I mean, can you imagine having some kind of, like, I don't know, let's say a Shadowrun-type data jack that's all wired around your brain, and then 5 years later they come out with a model that communicates 100 times faster, and now all of a sudden you have to go back under the knife again and redeal with all the surgical scarring.
Or you can't, because it's so grafted to your brain that you can't get rid of it.
You're stuck with it.
At which point you become a heroic pioneer in the field of biomechanics.
You know, Shadowrun actually did address that in a certain way, because, of course, the game you came out, they had your standard cyberware, and then as the game world advanced and the supplements came out,
we had the beta, gamma, and delta,
the alpha and beta cyberware, which, of course, had less essence costs and all that, but it was still the same units, the same equipment that you're putting in there, just didn't damage you as much,
right?
And getting into what you talk about, taking the game outward as opposed to upward. That actually, to me, is something that did a little bit of both, because that did present some interesting plot elements, because we had characters in our same party where one guy had a lot of old standard cyberware, the basics of models, and then there was another guy who had a lot of alpha and beta, more advanced cyberware, and it never quite got that way, but my character always had a lot of resentment toward this other guy because he was cybernetically so much more advanced than my character was. And, you know, there was a possibility for those, you know, plot complications and just inter-party conflict later on down the line.
I just can't imagine waking up one morning and realizing I'm an 8086.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, I can't imagine a world without inter-party conflict.
All right, well, speaking of inter-party conflict, let's move on from Chris's dirty closet to this is a question that was asked by one of our listeners whose forum handles Dr. X, and it actually ties into the party conflict topic we covered last show. He asked a question that I've had to deal with, but not often. It's usually we have to deal with the reverse extreme. But here's what he writes. He says, sorry if I've brought this one up before. However, it ties in nicely to episode 102, and it's something I still need help with. Episode 102 discussed dealing with party conflict. My problem is the need to create party conflict and not really being sure how to do it.
What?
I GM a horror a lot.
Do you GM for nuns?
And All Flesh Must Be Eaten, Year of the Zombie, and pretty much any other zombie RPG rulebook will tell you that the zombies are just a plot device, and the real story comes from party conflict. None of these games, however, gives advice on how to create this conflict. Presuming that your group is comprised of real-life friends who've gamed together for years, how do you get their characters to put self-interest before the common goal of survival if everyone gets along just peachy and works together as a team at all times? Now, first of all, Dr. X, let me tell you that you have the world's most perfect gaming group. This is like saying, like, this is a Brewster's Millions problem. Yeah, I've got so much money, what do I do with it? If you've got a group of friends that gets along that well, wow.
Well, that's the first distinction I wanted to make once we got to addressing this point, Dan. Make sure they realize that their inter-party conflict does not constitute them not getting along as friends. If they think, oh, well, I'm going to cut Bob off and get the one ring for myself and then he'll hate me forever because I just screwed him, they won't do it if they're good friends anyway. You'd have to be a big hole to do that for the sake of a game artifact. But tell them it's okay.
Well,
and then drop one thing in there that they all want and stymie their efforts to split it up.
And I don't want to rehash the substance of 102, but part of the issue here may be that if these are people where they're going to take it that seriously, one of the things you may have to ask yourself is, look, can these guys handle or do they even want inter-party conflict? And if the answer to that is no, if these are the type of people where they don't want it or they will take it too seriously, the answer may be you may be running the wrong type of game for them, that maybe it's time to either put aside the horror games or find a way to adapt horror games such that they don't rely so much on inter-party conflict to tell the story, to introduce additional factions or plot complexities or mysteries that keep them entertained without needing to have that constant mistrust of each other.
My newbies last weekend asked if they could hurt one another in-game, and I was like, well, it's a complicated answer. You can, but at this point in your 10-minute-old D&D career, inter-party conflict, we can get to later.
I think, you know, if you really are looking to have that, it kind of comes down really to a role-playing issue. From the description, it sounds like they're not necessarily really engaging in proper role-playing and proper character development. I mean, yeah, they certainly should get along all, you know, as fine as players, but as a game master, he needs to work with the player to develop elements about that character that on purpose fall into conflict with elements of other characters. You know, him with the GM knowing everything about the characters, if he wants that, he needs to kind of build those things in there and encourage that role playing amongst them.
Well, I completely agree with you because last episode, we kind of boiled down that most of the problems when party conflict goes too far is a failure of the group template or a discussion of, hey, this is the acceptable level of group conflict. And this one, I completely agree with you. I think it's on the opposite end that if your group's getting along perfectly, whether you wrote it out or not, somewhere subconsciously, you've got the group template perfect. Your issue is these characters may not be developed enough because the simple matter of fact is people don't get along all the time. I mean, we can even point to right now the situation we're having with Fear of the Boot, where even people that I'm still good friends with, just have other priorities or getting burnt out, whatever. And because of that, that's affecting the, you know, our goals are coming into conflict in terms of where we all want to try and get in life. And if you have a party that just gets along that perfectly, I would really ask, how well developed are these characters? And if you say, look, they've got great personalities, the next thing I'd ask is, okay, do these personalities, are they going anywhere? Do they have any goals? For example, the last zombie game that I played in, I was playing a Methodist preacher who had a wife and a congregation that was left behind somewhere that he could not get to.
Yeah, he was in New York on a conference or something.
Yeah.
And the zombies hit, and now he's on Manhattan Island with
right.
no means of communication.
So even though this guy, I mean, I was playing him as a, you know, good old boy sort of preacher who was nice and loving and full of compassion and honest and can be, but he still has this distinct interest in what happened to my wife, what happened to my kids and grandkids, what happened to my congregation, what happened to, you know, Bill, who I used to fish with all the time, while the party was more interested in trying to head west to find these survivalist enclaves. And did that cause this massive amount of conflict? No.
But there was tugging at either end of the party's collective decision-making
right.
process. Not with guns, but with just speaking.
And even if you look at some of your stereotypical, you know, zombie survivalist type archetypes, you know, if you have the bullheaded high school jock type character, you know, who wants to do things a certain way, but yet in that same group you've got the thinking nerd character who maybe has some other ideas about how to safely either avoid or take on these zombies, you're going to get into conflicts with those as well.
Yeah, you've got the reckless guy, the tempered brave guy, and the coward, and each of them wants to do something different, and who knows.
Well, and also something that Chris, I don't know whether it's intentional or not, at least alluded to there, is you can get in these games a spring up from the earth mentality, that this character, while he may have a history on paper, really began to exist the moment the GM started describing a setting. And that's not accurate, obviously. I mean, if you're trying to play this out carefully, okay, so you've got a zombie apocalypse game where you've got the nerd and the jock and the party, one or the other may have some suppressed anger towards the other for reasons.
Or that, not suppressed.
Yeah, or not suppressed anger for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with the current situation where, you know what, the jock doesn't take the nerd seriously and the nerd's got all kinds of pent up rage towards the jock just because of where they fall in social strata.
Yeah. Love triangle. Another good one.
Yeah. Love triangle would have worked perfectly. This did not come up in our game, but I was playing the Methodist minister. We could have easily had someone in the party who was angry at God for allowing the zombie.
I've been in there and that one.
Yeah.
Well, the castle game, Melina had her pagan ranger and I was a priest from Rome sent to kill her and get a grip back on this king, and that eventually came to blood that destroyed the game.
Well, that sounds a bit overt for a game where they can't even get conflict at all, so...
Oh, yeah, no, this game was nothing but...
But, I mean, you could still have something more subtle. Like I said, you've got the guy who's angry at God for allowing this to happen, and the guy who's still got his faith in God or whatever. That right there, you've got some kind of tension. And that doesn't need to reach any level the players are uncomfortable with. It doesn't need to come to party murder or theft or anything.
It comes down to intimate GM involvement and coaching. If the GM does really sit down and helps develop that background with that player and then takes that step and reminds him, saying, you know, these have always been important things for you. These are values you've always held dear. This is stuff that matters to you, and you have issues with people who don't necessarily always agree with you. You know, you've got to remember this as we sit down to play this game, that look at it from the long-term perspective. You know, exactly like you said, you didn't spring up out of the earth. This character has been alive for X number of years and has held these beliefs for X number of years. This is important. You know, the GM has to make that point so that the player going into the session knows this and has this kind of very top of mind awareness about what they've just talked about. And so it takes that with them.
And it's also something that the GM can try and play up in the plot. For example, if you've got the guy, the zombie apocalypse, keep using this gentleman's example, who's looking for his wife while everyone else is trying to survive, set up a situation where you've got a lead where this guy's wife might be somewhere out yonder, and that's not really safe to go there. And this puts the desires of the party in conflict with the desires of the individual. And once again, you got to watch where this goes. But give them some kind of a reason to clash, because if you only present them with one objective at a time or a handful of objectives that really don't strongly conflict with each other, where there's some reasonable way to hit them all, or there's not that much loss in trying to hit one before the other,
then there's no conflict.
Then yeah, you can't expect them to have conflict, because what's to fight over? If everybody wins, then what's to fight over?
Exactly. You have to write in those situations to happen.
And you can give both feuding players 50 experience points at the end of a good scene, and then they'll be happy to do it again.
Yes.
I guess the reason I've never had to struggle with this much is in almost every gaming group I've had, there's always at least one jackass. There's always at least one person who gets a cheap thrill out of stirring the pot in some way.
Yeah, there's usually a jackass. I'm not going to say always. The problem that my mind went to was the two people who seriously have personality conflict or power struggle with one another, and it would be a bad idea to jump that into a role play scene. For example, I know one pair of boyfriend and girlfriend that will not GM for one another or under one another because they just wouldn't take it. It would be too much authority in the other one's hand. So you wouldn't want to put them in competing characters because a fight would break out and you want to avoid the fight.
It's talk about the OOCIC issue there. I remember Mike and Tim used to consistently bicker in the game just because of the fact that out of the game, they had so many personality clashes and differences of opinion. And they were friends. I mean, it's not like they were at each other's throat.
Yeah.
But this would always spill over into the game because you can't change the fact that no matter how good you are at role-playing, it's still you role-playing the character.
With that guy.
Yeah, with that guy.
Known and have opinions about.
Right. And you cannot change that when you sit down at a role-playing game, no matter how hard you try. So that spilled over a lot. What Chris mentioned earlier of the GM being very hands-on, I think is absolutely important to this. Be there every step of the way. If you want to create a level of conflict and it's just not happening, then sit down with these people when they do the group template, sit down with them when they create the characters, talk to them before and after game sessions, and try to foster it. And I'd be careful, because if your group is not fighting, it sounds like they're probably adverse to that to begin with. And I'm just guessing here because Dr. X didn't state specifically, but if you have a group where if they fight in character, it's going to spill into an out of character brawl as well, then you definitely want to take it slow.
Even if they won't. I mean, there are PvP servers and PvE servers in the world in all our various hobbies
right. For
lots of good reasons. If you have four or five people who just want to get together and cooperate, and part of the thrill of the fantasy is coming together and beating the dragon, cool. They don't have to fight one another.
Yeah.
I joke that I have nightmares about a world with no inter-party conflict because I love it, but that doesn't make me right.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of where I started with this, is the issue here may be these may not be the best kinds of games for your players, or maybe not the best way to run them, that maybe you need to take what these zombie books say, throw it out the window, and instead add a whole lot of plot complexity and conflicting factions and a lot of uncertainty to the world.
Add the humans that are scrabbling against one another outside of the party into the setting.
Right.
Send in the Half-Life Death Squad. Send in the 28 weeks later army clamp down.
And then
all this stuff.
Three corporations, one of which created it, two of which are trying to control it.
And then all three of which want to kill you and each other.
Yeah, and then the foreign spy agency, and then the doomsday cult. And there's all kinds of stuff you can throw in there, and all kinds of mystery and intrigue and conflict without necessarily putting the party at each other's throat.
Yeah, you do have to do something other than, oh, zombies running away now again.
Because then you can still you can still get that thrill of there having been some good conflict, and that him have, but then they also get that good feeling of triumph then as well.
Yes.
Right.
You know,
And one thing too
related to, if it's not a group that doesn't necessarily feel comfortable with that in itself might be a worthwhile conversation to have. You know, having the game master remind everybody that, hey, you know, we are all still friends here, and say to them, this is an opportunity for you to go ahead and invent some of those things, but remembering then, of course, in the end, that we're all still friends, we all still get along,
right.
But this is just another way for us to express ourselves, and it's okay, and you can say mean things about Joe, and Joe can say mean things about Sandy, but neither one of them is necessarily going to end up hating each other, because they're going to realize it's more about the characters than about themselves.
All right, and like I was starting to say earlier, also make sure you introduce this at a pace they're ready to handle.
That yes.
If this is going to spill over into some kind of around the table conflict, then don't make it look like Bob killed Joe's wife. Make it, you know, find some level of conflict that these people are ready to handle. Introduce it slowly. Don't feel the need to push them into something. Because as we said countless times on the show, the point of this is to have fun. And if you ruin the fun or create some kind of real tension, you've lost. And that is the only way to lose at a role-playing game. And
that's sad, Dan. I didn't think I could lose D&D, but now I can.
You've never played Red Steel, have you?
No. What's Red Steel?
It's one of those mini fluff settings they poured out in the early to mid-90s that kind of came and went and really sucked. All right. Well, thank you guys for tuning in. And as Fear the Boot evolves and changes here over the next couple of weeks, we will keep you guys posted on the changes we're making. And one way or another, we hope you will stick around, and we will catch you guys next time.
See you
later days.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2008, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.